for you at thinkoneforyou.org is the website. Of course, he's been a performance coach all over the country and in the sports world as well, including for the Super Bowl 50 winning Broncos, still working as the performance psychologist for the Rockies, Nuggets, Dolphins, and many others. Thanks for the time, Doctor. It's good to talk to you again. It's been a while. But with this draft 2 weeks away and with the Broncos having as much overhaul as they had, given so many new coaches, so many new people in their positions, how do you avoid a little bit of groupthink in these last 2 weeks?
That's a great question, Sean. You know, good to talk to you guys, Sean and Sandy. Groupthink permeates throughout the NFL. I'll tell you, I've seen it in draft rooms. I've seen it in personnel departments, whether it's on the college side or the pro side. And you have to protect from it. You literally have to encourage what we call divergent thinking in your rooms. And that is both on the scouting side of the college and the pro side. And I've seen it where it happens with teams. They invite divergent thinking. And then I've seen other teams that really, they have what would be we would call a groupthink mentality. And let me tell you what groupthink is, because we study this in performance psychology. And groupthink means that you literally are persuaded to think like other people in the room because of their nonverbal communication, their verbal communication, like leading questions like, well, don't you think this kid's speed and his hips are free and he's great as a linebacker? He's great. You know, instead of asking an open-ended question, like, what do you think about this kid? And so I've seen directors of player personnel start off a meeting and say, hey, we really like this kid. We might have a chance at him in the third round, X, Y, Z. And then they'll ask a question of a scout, and the scout knows that if I go against this guy, that could be perceived as insubordination. So the teams that invite divergent thinking and set that as a climate and culture, and I've seen directors of player personnel, vice presidents of player personnel literally say, hey, we're going to go around the table. We're going to talk about these kids. And when we talk about them, I want it to be your viewpoint. I want it to be what you perceive, what you think. And they encourage that diversity in thinking. And with those teams, when they do that, they get a rich database. The ones that have, the, like you mentioned, Sean, the groupthink mentality, they kind of stay where they are. And we've seen the results of that here in Denver recently. So you would hope that this year would bring something new in terms of the climate and culture, in terms of encouraging that diverse thinking.
When the Broncos brought in Nathaniel Hackett, all you heard about was collaboration. Everything that represented the antithesis of groupthink. As you perceive it, and you've worked these drafts before for various teams and developing personality profiles and the like, what do the good teams who have people like you involved, what are they doing, and what would you be doing, and what have you done, if you can describe it, in the past, across these final 2 weeks, how many people do you tend to interact with? And it does, I suspect, in the good organizations, go all the way to the top.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question, Sandy. The way it works is it starts back at the combine when you got the top, 335 kids, give or take a few. And then teams invite what they call their top 30. They bring in their top 30 players, interview them. And what that looks like is they visit with the strength and conditioning people. They visit with the front office people. They visit with the coaches. But they also visit with the team wellness coach or psychologist. And everybody's calling it something different these days. But they meet. So, for example, when I've done that with teams, to answer your question, what have I done? I spend 1 hour with each one of those 30 players that come in. And we've already done personality assessments on them. We send them out electronically prior to the combine, and they complete them. And then I run a report on those personality assessments, and we can literally tell Sandy and Sean things like conscientiousness, which is their motivation. And we can tell if it's internal or external. And we literally can depict who are players that, if they're going to be picked in the first 3 to 4 rounds, are they worthy of that from the neck up? And so when we look at things like conscientiousness, which is drive and motivation, when we look at openness, that means how flexible are they? What if they're a corner in college and you may want to make them a safety, or they're a rover and you want to make them an outside linebacker? Are they going to be open to that? And we can tell that with these personality assessments. And the last 2 weeks are critical, Sandy, because you start narrowing down, you know, who's going to be available. And you never know how these drafts are going to go, but you're always there. And what has worked with me is I'm always a phone call away if I'm not in the draft room. So the personnel department can call me and say, hey, we're getting ready to draft this kid at,
right,
you know, in the third round. And we like him from the neck down. What do you think from the neck up? And then I'll give him my assessment. And that's not necessarily going to be a green light or a red light, but it's going to give him another spoke within that wheel to make that decision. But I've got to tell you what, the best teams in the league, Sandy, understand the neck up, the mental side of the game. And what I've seen happen is everyone from the head coach and the owner get educated of how these personality assessments work. Because if they don't understand them, they tend to undervalue them. I've
right.
seen it. If they don't understand how these assessments fit in, they tend to undervalue and go right back as the default and just evaluate them from the neck down like it was done in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And now the greatest teams understand we better value that neck up because that's a difference maker. And we've seen what happens here in Denver when kids are taken in the first and second round. And they didn't change physically, but they were able to regulate anxiety, and they were performing on what's called that sympathetic side of the autonomic nervous system, where that is not where performance lives, and that's called stress and anxiety.
Given the importance, Rick, of the quarterback position now, there are those, including my partner, who theorize that there will never again be a draft in which at least one quarterback – at least one quarterback is not selected in the top 10. From your perspective, you know how teams think, and you know how desperate teams can be if they don't have their guy, their quarterback of the future, as the Broncos certainly did not have, at least until they made the Russell Wilson trade. Do you agree with that? That regardless of the perceived quality of the quarterbacking class, there will never be a time during which, in a draft, at least one quarterback is not taken in the top 10.
Yeah, no, I don't think – I disagree with that if I'm listening to the question right. I do not think you have to take a quarterback in the top 10.
All right.
Because I think quarterbacks can be developed. And in fact, I think the best ones often are. I mean, if we look, you know, obviously Peyton was the first rounder, but you look at Tom and you look at some of the other ones that have had great success, they've been developed. And that's the other thing I see, Sandy and Sean, with great teams is they develop their players. A lot of times teams will draft a quarterback, for example. And let's take Drew Lock as a perfect example. And I personally think he wasn't developed like he could have been. And I think he's going to go up to Seattle, and I really hope he has success. Not to show up the Broncos or anything like that, but for his sake of his career, I hope he gets developed. And as you know, Sandy, I work very closely with some quarterback coaches throughout this league.
Right.
They're my clients, and I work with them. And so I coach those coaches, and I know what they're doing with their quarterbacks. And there's a couple quarterback coaches throughout the league that are known for really developing their quarterbacks and understanding how to develop them from the neck up. Some teams, Sean and Sandy, do not have a clue of how to develop a kid from the neck up. And so what they do, they're a throwaway draft pick. They don't show up, they don't develop, and they just move on. And there's so much money in the NFL that they can do that. But I can tell you this, if this were a corporation, they would not have so many throwaway picks, because corporate performance, the Googles, the Apples, the top performing companies in the world, and people hear me talk about that because they're very similar to football teams. They're run by human capital, and that's people. The top organizations in the world develop their people. It's a great investment to do it. But there's so much money in the NFL that they can afford to throw away draft picks, and that's what we see happen. And that's why teams get frustrated and they get to the point when they have to go into free agency and say, well, let's take this kid. At least we know he did it for them. So he's potentially going to do it for us. And that's the theory behind getting Russell Wilson.
We're talking to Dr. Rick Prey on the Johnson Auto Plaza hotline. And I want to see if we can flip this a little bit. We get this discussion all the time when it comes to analytics or counting stats, right? Where people look at analytics and say, well, I don't want to use analytics. I want to just look at it with my eyes. And people realize that, look, they're sort of different tools in the same toolbox, but not every tool is right for every circumstance. And so when some of the personality tests and the situations with certain draft picks, when are there times when you think, okay, you know what? The normal rules don't necessarily fit for this particular person, and maybe we should de-emphasize some of it.
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. Like, for example, let's stay with the quarterback position because it's, you know, basically the most visible leadership position on the field. The difference between a player being successful in college at the quarterback is often the neck up. It really is, because they've already tested how they throw the ball. They already tested their footwork, their technique, their ability to see. They get them in the classroom. When we do the top 30 interviews, the coaches bring them in on the whiteboard and they have them draw up plays and they understand their cognitive, their thinking processes. But what happens is that in the midst of the more complex coverages that a quarterback will face, the more complex stemming, like what that means is movement from the defense before the ball is snapped. People don't talk about that a lot, but stemming is when the defense shifts in the front seven before the snap of the ball, or the DBs. The DBs will show a cover two, and then they roll into a three right at the snap of the ball. That's all cognitive processing for the quarterback. And it's up to the quarterback coach to be able to help those quarterbacks develop that skill set. I've been in NFL rooms with quarterbacks, coaches, and their quarterbacks. And I've seen people like, I don't want to mention names, but I mean, I will use a name. Let's take the kid from Alabama, McCarron. You know, you look at him at Alabama, and he had a lot of success there. And then you look at him in the NFL. And he was never really given that opportunity because he would tend to throw the ball into coverage. He would tend to make mistakes in practice, so he never really got that opportunity. But I can tell you what, I've been in a room with him with the Cincinnati Bengals, for example, several years ago. And I can tell you this, the players loved it. Whenever he got in the game, they were rallied behind him. But the coaches thought there was too much risk reward with him. So that's when the development comes in, Sean and Sandy. And again, depending on the team, some people are great at developing those kids and some people don't. AJ McCarron could have been a starter in this league, in my opinion, if he would have been developed. And that's no knock on the coaches that had him. I think it's more on a knock of the ownership being, you know, telling the coaches that they want them to, you know, go with a certain person, and sometimes that overrules everything. So in this league, I can tell you this, coming up to the draft, like right now, in fact, I'm communicating with some teams tonight after I get off the phone with you, but I got to tell you this, we have got to get better in the league overall in personnel departments, on the college side, on the pro side, at understanding how to read these personality assessments, because they can make the difference, and we've seen a few quarterbacks here in the last 5 to 7 years that prove my point.
This is a bit unrelated, but I wanted to ask you, because I'm used to asking you questions when I get confused about things. And this Jamal Murray Nugget situation, well known to, I'm sure, virtually all our listeners. I don't need to recap all of the details. And I know you, having worked with the Nuggets and having been around Jamal Murray and having been around Tim Connelly and having been around Michael Malone, you're as good a person as I can think of to answer this question I have. I'm just going to give you a quote, and it comes from yesterday. This is Michael Malone talking about Jamal Murray's status for the playoffs, and I want to get your interpretation of the quote, if you wouldn't mind giving it. Here's Malone. I would lean more towards Murray being doubtful at this time. He's talking about for the series upcoming with Golden State. But I haven't closed that door. We'll see how this series goes and how Jamal feels, but zero pressure from me to Jamal. He's going to come back when he's ready. Decipher that for me, if you could. Is that pressure to come back? Is it more or less your decision and your decision alone? How do you interpret that statement?
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of an oxymoron in the sense that when a coach says no pressure for me, subconsciously they're exerting pressure by saying that.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's really interesting, you know, back when I was an athlete, which was quite a few years ago, but, you know, the decision wasn't up to the player per se. That would be a part of the information. The trainer would ask you, how are you feeling? You know, what's your range of motion? They'd measure your range of motion.
Yes.
They'd be able to, from a quantitative and analytical perspective, be able to measure your strength in your leg, your strength in your knee, the strength in the range of motion. And then there'd be a collective decision. It wouldn't be, you know, when he's ready. I mean, because now we're talking about personality. Now we're talking about how psychology comes into coming back from injuries. Everybody handles pain differently. Everybody handles the perception of an injury differently.
Yes.
Some people play through that. And some people think they have to feel 100% before they step back on the floor or the field. I can tell you, have been around that team, like as you mentioned, Sandy, I don't think it's necessarily the right plan to have to give, if they are giving the decision to Jamal. I think it needs to be more of a collective and collaborative decision and say, look, you know what, you're not going to feel 100% this year. You're just not. And accept that, understand it. If you can help us, great, but if you can't, let's move on. Instead of this constant, like, soap opera of, well, let's, you know, I'm not ruling it out, I'm not ruling it in, and I just think, let's make a decision, let's go with it and move forward, because otherwise the other players are affected on the team in terms of playing time and their role and things like that. Jamal is definitely, obviously, a great, great player, but at the same time, his psychology is influencing this. Mike's psychology, Malone that is influencing this. Even the front office and Tim is influencing this. But I just think there's a point where you're going to say to the athlete, you know what, you may not feel 100% physiologically, but you know what, you can make up for that psychologically by being tough-minded, mindful, and really commit yourself to your teammates to give a full effort and energy and have a great attitude going forward, and that'll make up for that other 20%.
He is Dr. Rick Perea, performance coach, obviously worked with the Broncos in their Super Bowl 50 season, works with the Nuggets, the Rockies, the Dolphins, among others. Make sure you check his website out at thinkone4u.org. That's thinkone4u.org for more. Always good to talk to you, Doctor. Thank you for the time.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, guys. Just remember, listeners out there, always love, trust, and believe in each other. You know, always support each other because we need it in this day and age.
All right. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it. Dr. Rick Prey on the Johnson Auto Plaza hotline.
What a great answer on the Murray question. I mean, that much.